Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Melania Trump, Donald's wife, is on a week-long trip to countries on the continent of Africa. Right now, she's in Ghana, then she'll travel to Malawi, then Kenya, and finally to Egypt. Her trip is being touted as a gesture of goodwill or soft diplomacy, but it really seems to be another one of her husband's marketing ploys. She is there to primarily highlight programs funded by the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, but her husband's administration has proposed massive cuts to USAID's budget. She's expected to tour an elephant and rhino conservatory in Kenya, even though the Trump administration loosened regulations on trophy hunting and the import of elephant tusks and other animal parts. In addition, prominent members of the Trump family are big game hunters. Gil Scott Heron once said, "America, the international Jekyll and Hyde, the land of a thousand disguises, sneaks up on you, but rarely surprises." What's going on here? For insight into this, into the game of America marketing, we turn to my next guest. He's an activist and journalist. He and Robert Serivant are co-authors of the forthcoming book entitled American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, A People's History of Fake News from the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror. Danny Haifong, welcome to The Critical Hour.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And let me also make note that Jamu Baraka has written a foreword to your book and Glenn Ford is writing the afterword to your book, correct?
Correct.
Man, that's great. You got some real high-powered intellects on working with you, and you being one of them. That's quite a team. So I see Melania's trip to Africa right in line with the premise of your book. She's traversing the continent promoting programs that her husband is cutting.
Yeah, it's an interesting development. I think the Trump administration has sort of been a windfall of American exceptionalism. What we've seen is that the Trump administration has kind of waged a war on a lot of the institutions of international finance as well as international aid, and has done so on the basis of for political reasons, mainly to look like he's standing up for the quote-unquote American worker, which we in our book talk about as heavily ingrained and shaped by white supremacy and this notion that, you know, American nationalism signifies the exceptional character of the U.S. nation state and how all of that really goes into greater justifications for war and plunder in places and in continents like Africa. What's interesting, I think, about the Melania Trump trip is that she's going around the continent talking about all the things that the administration is going to be doing, and also going around promoting an image that the United States cares about Africa, but yet the Trump administration has said very little about policies that the Obama administration was really invested in, such as AFRICOM, for example, the recolonization of the African continent. And a lot of Trump's wars against aid is not on the basis of actually promoting independence, the independent development of African countries. It's really based on political reasons. So in our book, we talk a lot about this. There are two sides to American exceptionalism that both end up promoting empire. There's the one side, the Trump alternative, so to speak, where he veers to the right and talks about how we need to make America great again on the basis of some mythical sort of white supremacist haven that is isolated from the world. And then there's the other side that promotes things like USAID and international relations with countries around the world, but mostly on the basis of ensuring the dependence of the African continent, Latin America, Asia, and places around the world to international finance, to the institutions of American power. So there's two sides to it, I think, and that's what makes this trip pretty interesting, I think.
Well, and two, when you tie Melania's trip to Donald Trump's opening or his address to the United Nations Security Council, where he spoke in what you just referenced, where he spoke directly about foreign aid. And the foreign aid really now seems to be, he wants to use the foreign aid as a bludgeon, or more like the sword of Damocles, over the head of countries, instead of understanding the very fundamental politics, the true soft power of U.S. foreign aid. And you can win more people feeding them than you can win over more people shooting them.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think one thing that Trump takes advantage of is that he comes up in a period of great crisis for the U.S. Imperialist system. And one of the crises that the system is going through is the fact that the rhetoric doesn't match to reality. And we've basically reached a point where the world is going in a different direction, and the Trump administration sort of fills this political vacuum that exists in the United States, where most of the population, or much of it, is pretty sick of the difference between the rhetoric and reality of things. And so he's been able to seize this and pull some folks to the right. And I think what is important about this aid conversation, and we talked about it in the book, we have a couple of chapters actually dedicated to it, is recognizing that a lot of aid structures have actually fueled dependency and promoted neocolonialism around the world, and that part of the reason he's able to critique these systems from the right is because actually there is this need to critique these systems, but his direction is not necessarily the direction that I think that progressive and radical-minded people want to be going. And I think the right direction is actually opposing any escalation of the replacement of aid with more hostile acts of military intervention, and critiquing it from the standpoint of actually, if you look at how aid is structured around the world, through the international agencies, we see that those countries that promote or that receive most aid happen to also be those that multinational capital, backed by the United States, is plundering and basically making dependent on aid so they can get rich. And we have to also then look at how these countries also end up becoming embedded to the U.S. military state, as a result of their deep dependency and as a result of their country's governments being heavily aligned with the United States.
One of the agents of this international aid would be the International Monetary Fund, the IMF. And when people really start to investigate the conditions under which loans or aid is provided, when they look at the fact, for example, and I know you have studied this deeper than I have, so help me out if I'm wrong here, but a country comes to IMF and says, we want to build schools and a water project. And they say, no, we'll build you an airport. No, well, we really need schools and water, but we're going to build you an airport. We'll give you $50 million for an airport. And why? Because Bechtel doesn't build schools and water projects. Bechtel builds airports. Is there any validity to that story?
Yeah, you know, we write about the IMF in the book, talking about it as one of the institutions of international finance and aid that promotes American exceptionalism, because the IMF and the Bretton Woods institutions are dominated by the United States. The United States shapes a lot of the policy. It's starting to shift a little bit, but for the most part, the United States and its allies are the ones who are really directing how the IMF conducts business, and how it conducts business historically has been through things called the structural adjustment plans. And what these are is kind of what you were alluding to. It's dangling aid, development aid to countries in the form of debt, promising to build things that mostly are catered to the interests of foreign capital. And one of the stipulations of structural adjustment programs is to allow these foreign corporations to be able to have basically free service to the natural resources and the institutions of the country. So oftentimes that means that when countries say, we need healthcare, please give us aid, the IMF is saying, okay, we'll give you aid, privatize your healthcare system, privatize your education system, privatize your infrastructure, privatize your agricultural system.
So it's a money laundering scheme. It's a money laundering scheme.
Yeah, and what we see from the African continent is that the continent as a whole runs a deficit almost about $60 billion per year, even though it's producing a lot more than what it's getting. And what's happening is that what the African continent produces for the most part ends up going elsewhere in terms of the revenue and the capital that it produces ends up leaving the country. And that's why, even The Guardian has written about how much the continent is losing despite all of the aid that it receives.
Let's shift gears and talk about your latest op-ed, Class Struggle in the Age of U.S. Imperial Decline, which people can find at Black Agenda Report, Class Struggle in the Age of U.S. Imperial Decline. And what I really wanted to get to is the part of your piece where you talk about identity politics and how that you talk about class struggle under U.S. imperialism is a complex phenomenon. And you talk about the rise of identity politics. Talk about that, please.
Yeah. So, I wrote this article because, one in part, I'm back in school and I'm kind of back on this college campus environment. And, I feel like the academy in this country is very influential when it comes to left politics. And unfortunately, what has ended up happening is because the class struggle is in such retreat in the United States, these workers, oppressed people, the Black Liberation Movement has been in such retreat for some time now. I feel like the ideologies of the academy, of the nonprofit industrial complex, have become the narrative from which a lot of activists, organizers, even radical intellectuals are basing their theoretical analysis, are basing their political activity off of. And it's become very problematic because a lot of the ideas that emanate from the academy are often divorced, ironically, from history and from any sort of class analysis. So I wrote this article to talk about how this is a big problem because we need to really get back to a politics of class struggle. We need to start studying relations in the United States, relations around the world from the standpoint of who has power and who doesn't. And until we ask that question in our political activities, we can't really understand the history behind this. We can't understand why the United States spent so much money on war. We can't understand why the Black Liberation Movement has been in retreat and why because of that, the class struggle is in retreat. Because I talk about in the article how the Black Liberation Movement has always been at the forefront of the class struggle in the United States because of the peculiar institution of white supremacy. So, I feel like what's important to understand about quote-unquote identity politics, because there's really no other term that can replace it right now, even though it's very insufficient to describe it, is that what the nonprofit industrial complex with the academy has done is it has almost acted as the follow-up to COINTELPRO. It has used a politics of division, a politics of anti-solidarity to describe conditions for activists, organizers, and progressive people to latch onto in order to promote their particular issue, their single issue, their particular identity, whatever it may be. And this has come at great cost because most of this language that's used, whether it's intersectionality or whether it's identity, this language is divorced a lot of times from poor people and from, oppressed people, especially around the world who, are waging their own struggles for self-determination and liberation. And we can't even begin to look at that when we're stuck in this morass of, well, who is more oppressed than whom? How many identities do I have until I'm the most oppressed and have authority over a political struggle, when in fact who has authority over a political struggle is not determined by an individual's just experience. It's determined by what's happening on the ground collectively as a class. And that's what I try to talk about in the article.
Well, it's been a ploy, it's been a tactic used by the manufacturing class in this country almost since it's been a country. I mean, you have the book The Half Has Never Been Told by Edward Baptist. You have Slavery by Another Name by Douglas Blackman. They talk about how, for example, at the end of slavery, as the newly freed slaves and the working class whites tried to come together and work cooperatively, a division was driven between them, with race being used as that wedge. And so we have found that in this country, whether it's Italians and Irish immigrants being pitted against each other, or Polish immigrants and German immigrants being pitted against each other in order to be sure that there's a labor class that can be exploited. That has been a tactic, as you're very much aware. That's been a tactic, an age-old tactic being used in this country. And now, I think, with the added element of individualism being promoted in this country, and so that identity politics is playing into that individualism as well. You know, blame the poor for their plight. I got mine, you get yours. All those types of things. That's really feeding or fanning the flames of these problems. Would you say that's fair?
I would say that's fair. I would say also, too, that one of the things about identity politics that's really interesting about this moment is how it's been embraced by people who call themselves progressive, people who call themselves radicals, and a lot of the things that you described were ruling class policies that fueled white supremacy and fueled antagonism. And so now what's interesting about identity politics in this period is how they manifest themselves in so-called progressive struggles that are really about what we talk about in our book, are really about projects to save the United States system of imperialism from itself. They're really to kind of give it a more progressive veneer. We talk a lot about
the neoliberal policies.
Exactly. We talk a lot about how the Obama administration, this idea of a black president, allowed for a lot of neoliberal policies, a lot of imperial policies to be exacerbated because his administration was promoted as progress. It was a development that projected this idea that the United States was becoming a more perfect union, and that was because there was this trend towards seeing some politics of symbolism and this politics of identity as being primary over the politics of material struggle and of class struggle, which ended up really being a devastating development where people's lives, especially black people's lives, got a lot worse in the United States and around the world, despite it all. So we try to intervene in our book in this conversation by saying, actually, when these politics are embraced, conditions for people become a lot worse. So we need to challenge the very ideology that allows progressive-minded people, radicals, whoever, to think that this politics of symbolism is a politics of real material progress.
Let me close with your words. The class struggle under U.S. imperialism is a complex phenomenon. White supremacy has ensured that workers in the U.S. and the Western orbit are divided along racial lines. The material and psychological wages of whiteness have left the class struggle in the U.S. in an especially weak state, with labor unions fragmented even in their strongest years, and black Americans, indigenous people, and others deemed non-white, subjected to the most extreme forms of state violence and terror. That's good work, Danny Haifong. That's good work. Hey, man, class struggle in the age of U.S. imperial decline is the article. You can find it in Black Agenda Report. And again, your book is due out in April. And the title of your book?
It is American Exceptionalism, American Innocence, a People's History of Fake News from the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror.
Danny Haifong, thanks for coming on A Critical Hour.
Thank you.
Man, thank you. All right, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. According to a new but unpublished report by Department of Homeland Security, the Trump administration's zero-tolerance crackdown at the border this spring was troubled from the outset by planning shortfalls, widespread communication failures, and administrative indifference to the separation of small children from their parents. The DHS Office of Inspector General's review found at least 860 migrant children were left in Border Patrol holding cells longer than the 72-hour limit mandated by U.S. courts, with one minor confined for 12 days and another for 25. My next guest has published her own report entitled, Whose Moral Stain? Hold Democrats Accountable on Immigration Too. She's a longtime environmental attorney and organizer and the author of What It Will Take, Rejecting Dead Ends and False Friends in the Fight for the Earth. Carol Dansereau, welcome to The Critical Hour.
Thank you very much. It's very nice to be here.
Before we get to your report, talk a little bit about these latest findings and what do they indicate to you?
Well, what's been happening on the border under Donald Trump is truly despicable. And seeing children separated from their parents and held in these atrocious conditions is thoroughly unacceptable. But what we need to realize is that family separation is not a new thing. We hear about this moral stain of the Trump administration's treatment of children and of immigrants, but it doesn't make sense to from there go to the assumption that the thing to do is to go out and rally behind the Democrats, because you did have children separated in huge numbers by the Democratic administration of Barack Obama from their families. Now, a lot of that was families in the interior of the United States where there were raids or parents were picked up in other ways. But we are talking literally about hundreds and hundreds of thousands of children who lost their parents to deportation. Meanwhile, at the border, the Obama administration dealt with this influx of unaccompanied children who were held in holding pens in conditions that were quite atrocious. And you also had, as a matter of course, when families came across the border, you had fathers routinely separated, so you had ongoing separation of fathers. And mothers were generally allowed to stay with their smaller children, but often older children, children like 11 years old, would be held in separate holding areas. And children who came with beloved aunts or other people who were not their actual mother, they were separated. They were taken apart from their families. So the separation of families is not a new situation. And in terms of children being held in detention for long periods of time, I don't have the statistics on how long the children who came as unaccompanied children to the United States were held under Obama. It is extremely difficult to get the data on that. But we do know that children were held for lengthy periods in family detention with their mothers. And in fact, there were hunger strikes and other protests that tried to draw attention to the fact that children were being raised in confinement for quite long periods of time, including, you know, many, many months and even going over into years with their parents.
Why is the data on that particular issue so hard to gather? Is it that the data has not been collected, that the data has not been collected accurately, or they're just or getting access to the data is the challenge?
I'm not exactly sure why it's so hard. I just know that as I was watching what was happening on the border, I said, well, I need to compare what happened before, because I was familiar with things in general, but I thought I should get some numbers. And you just search and you search. You try going to the ICE websites and other websites, Immigration Customs Enforcement, ICE, and the data is just hard to come by. I find that in general, what was happening to children and families under Barack Obama just didn't get the kind of attention that it should have gotten. And there was a very bad silence that was accompanied what was going on from folks who considered themselves Democrats and didn't want to put in a bad light their president and their party.
Was the discussion about the Dreamers and the Dream Act, and there was a lot of very positive dialogue and discussion, some might call it spin, around the Obama administration's immigration policy, again, spearheaded by the whole discussion about the Dream Act. Is do you think that that was used as a ruse to kind of cover what was being done behind the scenes? Because in your report, you cite, for example, over 152,000 children lost a parent to deportation in the year 2012 alone. You talk about the Obama administration deported over 3 million people. That's more than all presidents before him since 1890. And in fact, Barack Obama was dubbed the deporter in chief. So you write here, between 41% and 69% of Obama's deportees each year had not been convicted of any crimes. He set the goal of deporting 400,000 people a year, and immigration agents were pressured to sweep up as many people as they could in order to meet their goal. But most of what we heard about was the Dream Act.
That's right. One important thing to understand is that candidate Barack Obama promised that in his first year in office, he would push through immigration reform. People would get that pathway to citizenship that they wanted. But he didn't do that. He squandered the opportunity he had of Democratic control of both houses of Congress, as well as the White House. If the Democrats had been serious about immigration reform, the time to do it would have been when it was promised, in those first 2 years when the Democrats controlled all of Congress. But instead of that, Barack Obama came in and he said, we've got to batten down the hatches. You know, we've got to increase border security and we need to deport all these bad people. And we'll deal with, you know, immigration reform later. And so what he did was he literally tore families apart throughout the country. And part of how the depravity of this was hidden was that he made a big deal out of emphasizing that he was going after the bad people. He talked about, I'm going to be targeting the felons, not the families, the criminals, not the children. But when you look at the actual statistics, you have somewhere between 41 and 69% of people each year who had never been convicted of any crime. And then the ones who were the so-called criminals, the vast majority of those people were criminals because they had entered illegally the United States, and that had been criminalized. So you have this catch-22 of people who have no legal way of coming here, and then they're dubbed criminals because they came here illegally. And it was other crimes that dominated the so-called criminality of people that were being deported, included things like drug possession and traffic violations. So overwhelmingly, the people who were kicked out of the country under the guise of them being criminals were not people who posed any kind of threat. So the agenda of the Obama administration was one of expelling people from the country. It was one of beefing up the border wall, which, by the way, led to there were thousands of people who died along our borders, horrible deaths in the desert, drowning in the Rio Grande, because this border wall, which Democrats took leadership on, as well as Republicans took leadership on, funnels people into these dangerous places. And literally, thousands of people, nearly 3,000 is the official account, but that is missing a lot of people whose bodies were never found. So all of that was the focus, the supposed ridding the country of these criminals who weren't actually dangerous people, and the ridding the country of people who had never been convicted of any crime, people who were refugees from Central America, were expedited very swiftly and sent back with lots of people being murdered because they were sent back. So that's what dominated the Barack Obama years. But then, of course, he wanted to look like he cared about the immigrants. And so he offered DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which didn't provide anything except a reprieve from deportation. So it didn't provide that pathway to citizenship. And in fact, it forced people who wanted to have that reprieve, a temporary freedom from being deported, it required them to come out of the shadows and say, here I am, here's my name, here's where I live, making those people especially vulnerable to deportation later, including under Donald Trump. So I consider DACA to be a public relations ploy, something to make it look like there was concern for the rights of immigrants and for helping immigrants, but the record is truly reprehensible and caused tremendous, tremendous suffering, and in fact, many people suffering horrible deaths at the border and in the countries to which they were returned.
One of the problems that I see that people in this country get caught up in is what I call the politics of personality, and they ignore the politics of policy. And politics is supposed to be about policy output. So as now the focus is on Donald Trump and his deplorable rhetoric, Mexicans are rapists and all that foolishness. But are we really looking at President Obama and Trump working through U.S. policy, and the president really doesn't matter because they're both functionaries of the United States government? Does that make sense?
That makes sense to me. I think that we have been trapped in a system in which we have the Democrats versus the Republicans, and we many people make the mistake of believing that really is the only choice we have, is these two corporate-controlled parties who deliver very similar policies on these very important human rights issues and other issues. And in fact, one of the things that Barack Obama did that's just as despicable as the traumatizing of all those people who were deported and their children, just as despicable, was he gave these gifts to Donald Trump. Donald Trump can do so much harm right now because Barack Obama was president, and people just let it slide that this morally reprehensible activity was occurring vis-a-vis immigrants.
What gifts are you talking about?
Well, Donald Trump entered the office of the presidency, and he has more than 200 detention facilities around the U.S., most of which are in remote locations. You have in place enforcement agents for immigration who have been accused of rampant abuse, which was never investigated in any kind of meaningful way. I mean, there's ACLU reports about Border Patrol abuse of children in detention during the Obama years that use terms like, at best, we're talking neglectful, and at worst, we're talking sadistic treatment of these children. So you have these detention facilities in place. You have abuses that have been allowed to happen with impunity during the prior administration. And then you have Donald Trump come in, and he's got this massive infrastructure. He also has the ability to get from local law enforcement officials fingerprints for folks from anywhere in the United States who come in contact with local law enforcement officials, whether or not they've even been charged with a crime. So he's got this incredible surveillance capability. And the other gift that he's also got the legal precedents. You know, he's got statutes that criminalize immigration, illegal immigration, and that create expedited procedures for kicking people out of the country without them ever having a lawyer, and vast numbers never even getting a hearing with an immigration judge. Just, they called it the rocket docket, what happened under Obama. He used these expedited procedures provided by Bill Clinton to kick people out without any due process. So you have Donald Trump sitting there as president of the United States with this incredible machine for expelling people from the country and no accountability for what happened to people under that system. So he is in an incredibly powerful position.
So we have just a couple of minutes left, and I want to try and drill down to this point. You mentioned Bill Clinton. We've got about 2 minutes. You mentioned Bill Clinton to Barack Obama to Donald Trump. So what's at the crux of this deportation policy? The simple question would be, what's the end game? And the answer would be to get all these people out of the country. But there's got to be something else driving this policy. Do you have any insight into what that is?
You know, I don't think that I can answer what that is.
Okay.
I mean, I can say that in my experience, policies that hurt working people and pit working people against each other mm-hmm. serve the oligarchy that really has control in our country. So if you keep demonizing immigrants, and if you do, as Barack Obama did, link the idea of immigrants with the idea of crimes, you basically pit working people against working people.
Which has always been a ploy in this country, whether it was Irish workers, immigrants against Italian immigrants, or Polish immigrants against German immigrants.
Right. So, I mean, one of the things Barack Obama did was he linked in the public mind immigrants with crimes, even though immigrants as a whole are less engaged in crime than native-born people. He made a big point of supposedly going after criminals, and boy, there's millions of them to expel. So he created that. He helped to foster that narrative. And what the people in power get from all of this is that we remain divided. People think of immigrants as enemies, and people are vulnerable. The immigrants themselves, of course, are still here, still doing work, but they're here in the shadows, and therefore they are exploitable. You know, they can't leave their jobs. They can't object to the mistreatment on the jobs and the poor pay. So I guess the answer to your question, from my perspective, is that the reason this happens is that it keeps working people divided, and it keeps people living in the shadows, and that keeps the few who own most of our wealth in this country, the oligarchs, keeps them in power.
Carol Dansereau, thank you so much. Your piece, Whose Moral Stain? Hold Democrats Accountable on Immigration Too, can be found in Counterpunch. Carol Dansereau, thank you so much for coming to the Critical Hour.
Thank you very, very much for having me.
You're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back. We are back, and you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. According to my next guest, the loans ordinary Americans take out to purchase homes, attend college, and make ends meet often leave them in a sea of debt. Who is behind these fees, and what are the primary causes of increasing wealth inequality in America? Well, let's get these and the answers to other questions from my guest. He is the Arvra E. Strickland, Distinguished Professor of History, Black Studies, and Public Affairs at the University of Missouri, and joins us to discuss his latest book, Land of the Fee, Hidden Costs and the Decline of the American Middle Class, Professor Devin Fergus. Welcome to the Critical Hour.
Thank you, Wilmer, for having me. I'm very much looking forward to speaking with you about the project, yes.
Thank you. Thank you, man. You know, you write in your introduction, first, how you finance an asset can be as important as the asset. And second, while the Great Recession may have officially ended in 2009, fees continue to drain our bank accounts one drip at a time. Now, it may be patently obvious to some, but explain the asset finance quote, and then how did you come to focus on the issue of fees?
Sure. It's as I wrote in the book. It's much about how you finance an asset or a product, as much as the actual real estate or real product itself. And so, the classic example one could argue is home ownership. And so, what you find in home ownership is that in the run up to the Great Recession. And in the aftermath of the Great Recession, so many homeowners were actually, quote, underwater, which meant that they owed more than they owed on the house.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, that's because of upfront fees and costs, or hidden costs and fees, like prepayment penalties, balloon payments, and things like that. These sort of toxic sort of financial products, which are attached to whether it's a home loan or equity loan or even a student loan, and so it's these riders that are attached to actual final financial product, which weigh down the cost of those products. And so that's what I sort of exploring the text.
So as a professor of history, Black Studies, and Public Affairs, how did this whole issue of fees and the mortgage and the crisis, how did that come to within your purview?
Sure. And so I'm going to sort of say it came in my purview in a couple of ways. One is when I was a young man, back in my 20s, I actually studied abroad for a bit. And I came abroad with the working assumptions about this idea about American upward mobility, American exceptionalism, and that in the U.S. One could pull themselves up by their bootstraps, and only in the U.S. were you this sort of city on a hill. So I go abroad actually and live abroad for a period of time, and I live in a house in which all of my housemates were actually not simply people from different states that you may find if you go to college in the U.S., but actually from different parts of the world, actually from different continents. And almost all these individuals were actually first-generation college students who were then attending Cambridge University, one of the more elite universities in the UK. And mm-hmm. So it forced me to rethink my working assumptions about notions of up mobility in the U.S. And as I did, as I looked abroad and saw how these notions of up mobility were not simply exclusive to the U.S., it forced me to rethink my understandings and notions about what upward mobility looked like in America itself. And so I turned my gaze back on the U.S. and in the 1990s at this period of time. And where you find in the 1990s, this ostensibly this incredible period of macroeconomic growth, the longest period of U.S. economic growth in history. But at that same window of time, you also find increasing economic inequalities in the U.S., and particularly increased economic inequalities between racial groups and gender population in the U.S. So in the 1990s, you see where the wage gap may have stayed the same or actually even closed a little bit between, let's say, blacks and whites in the 1990s. But in the same window of time, you find actually a growing wealth gap between blacks and whites in the 1990s. And so how do you explain this ostensible anomaly? You explain that anomaly because that wealth is not simply a matter of wage, but wealth is a matter of what you owe minus what you own.
In fact, I wanted to go back to your point about how you finance an asset can be as important as an asset, because one of the adages that I remember hearing a long time ago was, in terms of buying a car, mm-hmm. that, for example, Ford is not selling you a car, they're selling you financing. And the car is just the no pun intended, vehicle that is used to sell you that financing.
No, absolutely right. Absolutely right. And that sort of really begins to change in many ways in the early part of the 20th century, actually. And so the financialization of the economy, which sort of then takes off to 1970s, 1980s, where you really see this major shift in scholars like Kim Phillips Fines and others have sort of talked about this. Greta Krippner, Lewis Hyman and others, Julia Ott, have talked about the increasing financialization of the economy throughout the 20th century. And so absolutely right. And so they're more interested in can sell you that sort of financial product than the actual product, the underlying physical product itself. Absolutely right.
Talk about how much these fees actually cost consumers. In your introduction, you talk about subprime mortgages, payday lending, student loans. How much are these things actually costing consumers?
Sure. In the aggregate, these fees and related costs, interest rates, and in many ways, you can even argue the principles of something like a student loan, for instance, are costing in the aggregate over $1 trillion. Estimates now is that even the student loan itself, in the aggregate, costs student loan holders $1.5 trillion. And so we're talking about a major sum of money, and we're also talking about the increasing number of fees and increasing price of these fees, because at this period of time there is no political incentive or political motivation to rein in these fees. And we see this at the end of the Obama administration's National Economic Council in late December 2016, talk about the growing trend and the magnitude of fees in the U.S. economy as a means of systematically transferring wealth from the rest to the rich. And it warns and it urges the next administration to do something about these out of control fees. And what we see in subsequent administration is that these fees have actually become almost even more egregious, actually, with the removal of financial cops off the beat. And this is, I think, is also an untold story in that what happens in the last two generations is that there was increased financial regulations, there were increased financial cops who were on the beat looking out for financial predation. And increasingly, the removal of financial cops off the beat. And we're seeing this right now with the way in which they're trying to roll back, for instance, the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, mm-hmm. As well as other examples of ways which are trying to roll back of regulatory oversight, even of things like student loans, actually. And so there's an increase, there's a removal, there's a soft on financial crime mentality. That pervades the current administration and the current government, and that only puts consumers in the crosshairs of individuals. Another example of this rollback is what we see with payday lending, in which the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau have sort of ended their sort of proactive oversight and supervisory exams of payday lenders and banks and credit card companies, who in particular target active duty military members. Mm. And they want to target these individuals because they're reliable. They know that they get a steady paycheck that they can actually target. And they actually know these individuals are compelled to pay to pay that money, because if they fall into hock or fall into debt, they run a great risk of losing their security clearances. And so in 2006, Congress passed a law called the Military Lending Act, which capped interest rates at 36% for loans given to military personnel. And now the CFPB is beginning to turn its back on trying to oversee and to supervise this practice of capping rates at 36%.
And that right there, a cap of 36% is thievery. Or precisely. In the financial world, the word I think would be usury.
Exactly.
But it's thievery.
Precisely. And again, I mean, yes, the Exemplar usury, right? It has a sort of a moral sort of language to it too, which I think in many ways that often gets short shrift. So we can talk about the economic consequences and material consequences for U.S. households. Any impact that it might have on the broader economy.
Talk about that in the context of the subprime, in the subprime bubble, because you write, as the subprime bubble grew even bigger, more than half of prime eligible borrowers with credit scores good enough to receive a cheaper loan were nudged into expensive subprime ones. And then you also write that the subprime was a significant factor in, though far from the sole contributor to, growing household debt.
Exactly. And so what we find with subprime is that it begins really in urban spaces. And let me take a step back. What happens in the 1970s really in the 1970s. I know subprime is a language that becomes popular in the 1990s. But really, you need to look back to the late sort of 70s to get a better understanding of it. So what happens in the mid-1970s is this is a genuine effort by policymakers and lawmakers to extend credit to historically disfranchised populations, and it's women and African Americans. We see this with something like the Equal Credit Opportunity Act of '74, Home Mortgage Disclosure Act in the mid 1970s, the CRA in 1977. So there's a genuine effort to expand credit, to democratize credit, as the language goes, in the 1970s. But that effort to expand and democratize credit to disfranchised populations is followed immediately by a erosion of oversight. So here you have a sort of toxic alchemy, Wilmer. On one hand, the democratization of credit, but on the second hand, you find that expanding credit without the watchful oversight of the federal government, and that creates a climate of predation. And this really gives, and this is what happens in so many urban pockets in the U.S. And so subprime, which is basically a description of the actual borrower, which basically means that the borrower is, quote, underprime, which usually is between having a credit score, at least historically between 620, under 620 and 660, means they have to have offer different financial products to these individuals. And so it really sort of targets these marginalized populations. But what subsequently happens is that once they saturate these markets, they begin to expand them. And they look beyond historically disfranchised populations to the broader economy. There's a greater demand to ship and shop these financial products to middle class populations, and this is what happens in the mid 2000s. So, there's a Wall Street Journal report or other that says that the average subprime borrower actually was prime worthy come 2005-2006 because these loans are incredibly profitable, and there's an incredible sort of secondary and securitization market for these actual products.
I'm sorry, let me just jump in real quick because I found that one sentence, as the subprime bubble grew even bigger, more than half of prime eligible borrowers with credit scores good enough to receive a cheaper conventional loan were nudged into an expensive subprime one, because that contradicts the stereotype that we were provided about who the targets of these loans were, who the benefactors, because the narrative was, oh, these were just irresponsible, money-hungry Black people that wanted to live, and other people of color that wanted to live beyond their means.
No, precisely right, and absolutely right. And what you even find in the early years of subprime is that they subprime home lenders and equity lenders, particularly equity lenders, their primary targets were those individuals who had equity in their properties, equity in their houses, and so it was not the individual who was these quote unquote ninja borrowers who had no income, no assets, no jobs, right? It was actually these what we consider the achievers of the American dream, those individuals who had worked hard, as the Clinton line goes, worked hard, played by the rules, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And purchased a home and actually built equity up at home. And they wanted people who built equity up at home because they were more interested in the equity in the property,
right,
than anything else. And so you're absolutely right that it disabuses us of this of the false narrative about who subprime lenders were actually targeting. We're targeting individuals with actual equity in their property, not those without equity.
Let me move you quickly, because we only have about 2 minutes left, to the point about one of the biggest impediments to advanced education in this country, this is me speaking, is not the subject matter, it's financing the education. So if you could just quickly talk about the origins of the student debt bubble.
Great question. And the origins of the student debt bubble actually comes from a very different place than what we were talking about, housing or mm-hmm. the subprime mortgage bubble. So the mortgage issue comes largely from the private sector who is driving the subprime bubble. The origins of the student debt bubble actually come out of the federal government in many ways, which has to incentivize the private sector to jump into the loan market. And just think about it from this perspective, in that here you are, 17, 18 year old, if you're a lender, 17, 18 year old kid, you have no job, you have no credit history, and I'm going to give you $5,000 on a promise that you're going to pay this back mm-hmm. 5 years from now.
Right.
Just the logistics of that seems irrational. So what the government has to do is they have to incentivize the financial sector so much to jump into this sector. And so what happens is they create such sweetens the pot so much for the lenders that it becomes a fail safe for the lenders. So regardless of even if a student borrower defaults to the loan, the creditor, the lender, actually winds up not losing almost any money. And so they're able to basically overcharge both the lender as well as these middlemen, which come into the student lending market, able to overcharge student borrowers. And so what you wind up is actually these student borrowers whose principal loan amount might be one thing, but the added fees and interest on top of that amount often is three or four times larger than the actual principal loan amount. And so we could talk much more about this. I know you know you're pressed for time. We could talk much more about this at a later juncture. We'd love to talk more about this, because the problem actually really originates with student loans more so than even with housing.
So in wrapping up, I just got to sign. I got to wrap up. Dr. Devin Fergus, Land of the Fee, Hidden Costs and the Decline of the American Middle Class. Fantastic, fantastic book. It really disproves a number of the stereotypes that we have been convinced are real. Again, Land of the Fee, Hidden Costs and the Decline of the American Middle Class, Devin Fergus. Thank you so much for coming to the Critical Hour.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you. Folks, another day, another Critical Hour. You've been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.